all across America and around the world. This is Veterans Radio.
This is Veterans Radio.
And now, your host for today's program, Bob Gould.
And welcome to another program of Veterans Radio. Bob Gould right here, spending Sunday afternoon with you. Right here, Veterans Radio. I'm all by myself today. Yeah, Nina's gone, Dale's gone, Jim's gone. They're all gone, but we're not gone. We're right here. We got a very exciting program. I've been wanting to do this for so long, and this program about the September Hope, that's Market Garden. It's the American version of A Bridge Too Far, and we have two very fine authors on the are they standing by now, Derek?
I gotta call the others.
Oh, okay, yeah. Well, we're all working here and making this thing come through. So anyway, September Hope is going to be our feature for today. Both John McManus and Kevin Himmel will be our guest offers. Before that, though, we like to get caught up on things, and here's an event recognizing Detroit's contribution to the arsenal of democracy. Okay, Rosie the Riveters, it will be Thursday, September 16th. At noon, 12 o'clock, American House, Farmington Hills, in partnership with the Detroit Historical Society. It's a special event. It's honoring real-life Rosie the Riveters at the Detroit Historical Museum. That's in Midtown Detroit. There will be a lunch, and it's courtesy of the American House culinary team. Following the meal, there will be speakers, and including Rob Gillette, the CEO and president of the American House folks. So there will also be a film. That's right. Keith Famey, 10-time Michigan Emmy Award-winning director and producer, will open the film premiere in the Booth Auditorium. That's Rosie the Riveters. You're going to want to be a part of that. That's Thursday, September 16th at 12 o'clock. So where do you go? RSVP, that seems kind of likely, RSVP at AmericanHouse.com. RSVP at AmericanHouse.com. Please, let us, you've only got 24 more hours before it closes. So that's Tuesday, September 16th at 12 o'clock, the Detroit Historical Society. We'll be right back with our program. So don't go away with this very important message.
Living at American House is like being on a cruise ship with all the lovely surroundings, the many, many activities, and the people to share with. It's so comfortable to be here. I feel safe. I don't have to shop. I don't have to cook. I don't have to clean up.
When you move into an American House senior living community, you open the door to a new world of possibilities. Our life enrichment directors are committed to enhancing the lives of residents every day. We look forward to finding out what interests you.
I just get dressed up and walk down to the dining room and enjoy my meals in the company of other people at my table.
For more moments made in American House, go to AmericanHouse.com. Again, that's AmericanHouse.com. Or watch us at YouTube.com/AmericanHouseLiving.
Living here has enriched my life. I'm Carol Huck, and I made in American House.
And we're back on Veterans Radio right here this Sunday afternoon at Talk 1600 Wham Talk Radio right here in beautiful, beautiful Ann Arbor, Michigan. You know, folks, we're very lucky to get the number of authors that have access to, and we don't like to talk about revisionist history because everything looks so much it's always 100% accurate when you're looking back, but some of the things that we are able to reveal and some of the stories that, you know, these authors, folks, they do all of this research. They spend years putting this all together. And I love it when we have features and topics like we do today It's all about Market Garden. That was the operation. Mm-hmm. Bridge Too Far. I'm sure most of you saw the movie. But that, what were all the little details behind it? And that's what we like to do here at Veterans Radio. So Veterans Radio is going to give a big welcome right now. The first, my first guest today is John C. McManus, Professor of Military History at Missouri University of Science and Technology. Professor McManus has written numerous books on World War II and also serves as a member of the editorial board at World War II magazine. John, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Hi, Bob. Good to be with you.
Well, it's good to have you. Our second guest, and this gentleman knows everything, every little detail, every little nuance about General George Patton. And General Patton is my favorite of favorites of favorites. I mean, if we want to talk about an iconic figure of what World War II, you just got to take a look at any photograph of Patton with his pistols and his ivory, don't you dare call him pearl handled, his ivory handled pistols and his always good bearing. I just love it. Well, Kevin Hemmel is a former historian for the U.S. Army's Combat Studies Institute. Ooh, boy, that must be a lot of stuff going on there. He's wrote military history narratives on the War of Afghanistan. He's the author of Patton's Photographs and Patton, Legendary World War II Commander. Kevin, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Hey, thanks for having me. Good to be here, Bob.
Okay, here we go. I'm rubbing my hands. I can't wait to get this thing started. Here we are.
Hello?
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 John, I can hear you. Can you guys hear me?
Kevin, I can hear you. I can't hear anybody
else.
Oh,
there we go. Hey. I was putting my wrist on the talkback button, and it's so. I mean, I'm going around talking to myself. I'm looking at my producer. He's throwing his hands up.
And in conclusion, Bob.
Yes, and anyway, yeah, that was a quick hour. Well, here we are. It's 1944. It's September. And Hitler is a wreck. I mean, he's on strychnine. He's on cocaine. He's on opiates. He's on meth. And Goering, he's a heroin addict because of his injuries during the Putsch back in the 30s. So he's now they have no Air Force. Hitler is way out of it. He's drugged up all the time. You got the Russians coming from the east. You got the Americans now are coming from the west. And things, why Market Garden? John, tell us about. About that.
Well, Market Garden follows in the wake of the Allied victory at Normandy in the summer of 1944, which destroys the better part of two whole German armies and eventually leads to the Allies liberating most of France, about 90 to 95% of France, portions of Belgium, much of Luxembourg, and then they also get into Holland. And there's a lot of optimism that Germany's on the verge of a complete and total collapse, really almost similar to what had happened to the Kaiser's Germany in the fall of 1918, and there were, of course, many Allied officers who remembered that. And so they felt, some of them did, with one more big push into Germany, that this could sort of collapse the remaining house of cards. It could take down Hitler's regime and end the war before Christmas. And the main officer who was pushing that blueprint was Field Marshal Bernard Montgomery of Great Britain.
Well, okay, first of all, I do want to comment. I was thinking about this. I mean, here it is, Market Garden. Yes, Operation Market Garden. Now, wouldn't it be the British would call it Market Garden, where the Americans, when they had it was Overlord. You know, Market, I mean, what if Market Garden was D-Day? Today, Market Garden. No, I don't think so. But Market Garden. And Montgomery, as he was about to have his... I mean, this guy had his head handed to him in Cannes. It took him 6 weeks, 7 weeks to break through at Cannes. He delayed to close the Feliz gap. This guy, I mean, he finally gets it together. And here Patton, after being frustrated, goes south and comes around the other side of the Germans because Monty can't break out of Cannes. Oh, tell us about that, John. What's going on with Montgomery?
Well, you know, in fairness to Montgomery, the British and the Canadians were taking on the most powerful formations in the German army in the West in the summer of 1944 around Cannes, and they were also dealing with, a lot of difficult terrain to advance on, pancake flat type of terrain, rolling country that, you know, was conducive to armor. Warfare, and they were taking on very, very powerful German armored formations before Cannes. So the idea that the Allies should have taken Cannes on D-Day or within the first day was always really rather ambitious. No one envisioned it would take them the months that it did, but even if they had taken Cannes, it didn't necessarily, you know, mean that the German army was going to be finished in Normandy. It was going to be a battle of attrition, and it took the strength of the British and the Canadians over there in the east, drawing up some of the most powerful formations, while the American army to the west dealt with the toughest terrain, the hedgerow bocage country that was so conducive to the defense. And so together, they kind of land these killing blows against the Germans, and eventually annihilate those armies and lead to the breakout and the liberation of Paris. So in the wake of that, then the question really is, what's best for what's next? Because the Allies are running into real logistical problems. They're just very difficult time supplying their armies. And this is why you end up with this kind of argument over whether the Allies ought to go more slowly, deliberate, on a broader front, which is primarily what Eisenhower envisioned, or a single thrust to try and win the war quickly while Germany was tottering. And, of course, Montgomery advocated that because he wanted a quick end of the war, and Patton did too. And in his own right, they both wanted priority for that push.
Well, okay. Now, Kevin, let's get to you. Let's go back to what was the relationship between Patton and Montgomery?
Started off poor, and from there it went to bitter. Patton at first respected Montgomery as a sort of a winning general, but he had a small clash with him in his first meeting. In fact, Montgomery put on sort of a conference for what his Eighth Army had done well in North Africa. Patton attended, and Montgomery didn't allow smoking in his meetings, and Patton almost put a cigarette to his mouth, and someone pulled it away. And later, when he was asked about that, you know, Patton said, well, you know, I might be old and stupid, but it didn't mean a thing, you know, that he couldn't smoke there. But the word got back to Montgomery that Patton was saying, I might be old and stupid, but his whole speech didn't mean a thing to me. And Montgomery took that as a great insult. In Sicily, Montgomery told Patton, he said, listen, I just do whatever I feel like on the battlefield, and I suggest you do the same. So when Patton sort of skirted off to the left and then started doing amphibious landings, he was almost taking Montgomery's advice. But as this was going on, he started to think that Montgomery was a sort of a pompous fool, to the point where when Patton is basically exiled in Sicily and he overhears that a British general said, we have to keep the reins on Patton, or else he'll completely surround Montgomery. Patton thought that was great, and he said, you know, I could run circles around that little, flatulence might be a better word than what he actually
yeah.
said.
A four-letter word starting with F and ending in T. Right.
Bingo. There we go. So by the time you get to September, because, you know, Patton really, exploits this breakout, races around the German left flank, and basically puts the squeeze on him, kind of enabling Montgomery to finally force, you know, the issue further north in Cannes and in that area. So when, you know, every Allied army ran out of gas, but to Patton it was personal. It was his army out of gas. And when he hears that, you know, Montgomery is fomenting a plan and that he's talking to Eisenhower about it, he actually tells Bradley, you know, hey, let's hand in our resignations. We shouldn't stand for this. But Bradley said, no, we're not going to do that, so Patton didn't. But that's how strongly Patton felt against Montgomery at that point.
Now, what's deep down inside between these two guys, I mean, they're super Eagles, and I have no problem with that. In order to lead the number of men that you have to lead and to do the things that you do, you have to have a huge, huge ego, and I don't have a problem with that. But getting back to these two giants, that were they racing to cross the Rhine to be the first one to be historically known as the one to get into Germany? What about that?
Yes, I think just about every general was feeling that, not just Patton, but Courtney Hodges with 1st Army, Patch with the 7th Army. You know, the faster the war is over, the more lives you save. But remember, at this point in the war, Patton is an Army commander and Montgomery is an Army group commander. So Patton doesn't really have that direct line connection to Eisenhower. He's talking to Bradley, who is really Montgomery's competitor. But Patton has a real sort of motivation on dates and being first to things. Constantly in his diaries and memoirs, he says, you know, 1 year ago today we landed in North Africa, or we took Messina. He's very aware of his own history as he's going through it and wants to keep sort of adding those notches on his belt. That's very much a part of Patton. I think with Montgomery, it's more, we've been getting a bloody nose from the Germans since 1940, and we really want to stick it to them, and this is how I'm going to do it. But it's kind of hard to compare him at this point of the war because, like I said, Patton is an Army commander. Montgomery is an Army group commander.
Now John, let's get back to you. This is the beginning of planning of Market Garden. Now they're going to do a blitzkrieg. They're going to cut through, knife through, have a breakout, and they're going to get right across, right into Germany and right into the Ruhr Valley and shorten the war by months and months and months. So this is going to take not only planning, but it's going to take some cooperation between, well, the Supreme Commander, General Eisenhower, and General Montgomery. So how was that playing out, John?
Well, that's what's interesting, too, and I want to piggyback on the story that Kevin told, fascinating story about the, you know, the sort of bad start between Patton and Montgomery. Curiously enough, Eisenhower and Montgomery had gotten off to a bad start for almost the same reason. Montgomery, at that time, was certainly famous in the British Army for hating smoking and not tolerating it in his headquarters. And in 1942, when Eisenhower was one of the first American commanders sent to England to spearhead what they thought would be an invasion that year, he sat in on a briefing in Montgomery's headquarters, and just like Patton had done, took out a cigarette and actually lit it. And Montgomery stopped his briefing and basically remonstrated Eisenhower, and Eisenhower snuffed out the cigarette. But he was none too pleased, and right there, he really had this kind of inner antipathy for Montgomery. And so over the years, of course, they had developed their relationship in North Africa and Sicily and eventually in the planning for Normandy and thereafter. And by the late summer 1944, Eisenhower really felt that Montgomery was a real gadfly for him. He was sick and tired of him. And there was real tension. There was not a lot of communication there between Eisenhower and his subordinates, not just Montgomery, but also Bradley. Because his headquarters was so far west and behind the lines. And Montgomery briefs Eisenhower. They finally meet on September the 10th in Eisenhower's plane on the tarmac of the Brussels airport. And Montgomery sells them on this concept, as you've mentioned, of a kind of an airborne and armored blitzkrieg through Holland, across the bridges of the major river systems, into northern Germany to hopefully end the war. And Eisenhower, though he's really skeptical of the plan at first, ultimately is very intrigued by the idea of seizing those bridgeheads and then developing them later. So in spite of his personal problems with Montgomery, and it had been a very stormy session they had that September 10th, he did feel there was a larger gain to make. Now, my personal opinion, and what I mentioned in my book, September Hope, is I feel this was Eisenhower's worst decision as Supreme Commander, because the operation is based primarily on just hope. And that's not a good foundation to build upon.
John, what did General Patton think of the when he was told of this operation? What did General Patton think?
None too pleased, because, of course, he wanted priority for a thrust of his own much farther to the south. He felt that his army, the Third Army, as Kevin, I'm sure, you know, can explain even far better than I can, could go straight into that western central portion of Germany like a knife in the vitals and destroy Germany's capacity to resist there. And he certainly did not want priority going to Montgomery. Part of it is the battle of egos, but also there is a sense that you know, the Americans are contributing about two-thirds of the manpower, material power, and most of the financial power to this, and really priority for this big push into Germany ought to go with the American army. There's a sense of national pride too, but Eisenhower had to look beyond that, of course, as the supreme commander.
Now, could we also draw, because Eisenhower really wasn't a combat commander. He was a logistics guy. Was that also part of the reason that he acquiesced to Montgomery?
Well, I don't know that I would completely describe him as a logistics guy, although he did appreciate that. Though he didn't have a lot of battle action command, he had always been an infantry officer and had always, thought in terms of being a staff officer and commanding troops. He really was a diplomatic commander. I think maybe that's almost the best way to think of him, as a political diplomatic general who understood how to keep all these egos in check, balance all the national interests, and to develop trust. And he was really exceptionally good at that. And that was his greatest asset as overall commander. And so when he hears about Market Garden, well, there's several issues that are going on. I mean, the airborne divisions, the Allies had deployed three of them in Normandy, and then they had been pulled out of combat, and they hadn't been used ever since. And the lines were moving so fast in the late summer that there were about a dozen and a half different operations planned in which the paratroopers would be dropped. But each time they had to be scotched because Allied troops overran the drop zone. So Eisenhower really wanted to get these units into combat. They were elite units. And he liked the idea of having a bridgehead over the major river systems. But he only saw it as that. And the mistake he makes is not understanding that when he gives priority to go ahead with Market Garden, it's going to be at the expense of everything else. That's just the reality of the moment. So it's going to diverge from his broad front, which I personally believe was the right approach. But and I think that events sort of bear that out in the fall of 44.
Well, so that meant that a lot of material, fuel, ammunition, etc., was now going in preparation for Market Garden. Kevin, what did that do with Patton's forces? Did he have to slow things down because of the supply situation?
He did to a degree, but also the terrain he was encountering by September was also adding to the slowdown of his army and his air force, which was working so perfectly in symphony with his ground troops, just tearing up the Germans in front of them, was getting pulled to fire on the ports back in western France that Eisenhower knew were so vital to open up. So Patton was losing other elements of his offensive action when the fuel became an ordeal, I guess you could say. And in the middle of September, he's having meetings with Bradley and Courtney Hodges, the commander of First Army, and he's accusing Hodges of stealing fuel from him. That's how concerned he is. Meanwhile, his armored units, particularly the 4th Armored Division, is really smashing toe-to-toe with the Germans in an area called Port-au-Basson. And they're coming out on top, but the fighting's becoming more intense. The Germans are sort of regrouping themselves. But he's bringing two divisions from the west to his front. He's developing tactical plans to break through. He's constantly thinking on the offensive, but he kind of feels like he's got that collar around him with the leash held by Eisenhower holding him back, that he's capable of so much more if they would just give him the tools he needs. But, you know, for Eisenhower, he's trying to figure out what to do with fuel and supplies that he has at such a limited basis and who to give them to. And I think one of the reasons that Montgomery's plan intrigued him, John was talking about the airborne units. Airborne units don't use the amount of fuel and other supplies or take the amount of fuel that's going to take to deliver supplies that an armored division is going to take. And so I think the fact that you could take these soldiers from England and drop them and resupply them from England without worrying about the logistics on the ground was a big plus that Patton couldn't offer him, but Patton could offer results. And Patton had a track record of saying, hey, you know, you give me whatever you can, and I'll make it work. He called it his rocks. soup method. You know, the old story where the homeless guy comes to the lady's house and he says he wants to make rock soup, and he's asking for vegetables, and she's so amazed at this idea of a rock in the middle of a bowl making soup that she gives him everything, and he makes soup out of it. That was Patton's, basically his logistics plan was called the rock soup plan.
John, we've got about 3 minutes before we go to the halfway break. What was the purpose of Market Garden?
The purpose of Market Garden is to drop three airborne divisions, one British and two U.S., plus a Polish parachute brigade, to capture three key bridges in Holland, basically near Eindhoven, Nijmegen, and what's often called a bridge too far, Arnhem, the ultimate bridge over the Lower Rhine, so that the paratroopers will capture these bridges and also a highway corridor through Holland, and then they will link up with British armor that then will speed through that corridor over the bridges into the northern plains of Germany, outflank the fortifications of the Siegfried Line on the Western Front, outflank the Ruhr River, perhaps get to Berlin, but basically unhinge the entire German situation in the entire German line. And it's predicated on the idea that the Germans are already in shock, that they're reeling, and that they're going to be very weak there. And it's, of course, a very flawed idea. They're anything but weak, and they react to it much more potently than the Allies could have ever envisioned.
Well, so they've now decided to go ahead and do this, and they're ready to jump off. So we have the Americans, we have the British, we have the Canadians, and the Polish. Is that right?
Right. There's a Polish parachute brigade. Most of the armor is British. Eventually, Canadians will serve in Holland, but they're not to be in on the initial operation. The American presence for this is the 82nd and 101st Airborne Divisions.
Okay, well, we're going to split right here. And speaking about divisions, we've got some very important messages coming up. Both you gentlemen, I'm sure, are going to sit right there and have yourself a little sip of the coffee. And here we are, Bob Gould at Talk Radio, WHAM 1600 on Veterans Radio. We're talking about September Hope with author John C. McManus and Kevin Himmel. We're going to be right back right after this very important message. Applebee's Restaurants is a proud sponsor of Veterans Radio. For the best in family dining, you'll want to make any Applebee's restaurant your destination for just plain good food, good service, and complimentary military discounts. So plan your next delicious out-to-dinner meal at Applebee's. That's Applebee's Restaurant. They help Veterans Radio deliver our program to you.
If you have a VA claim denied by the Board of Veterans Appeals, contact Legal Help for Veterans. At 1-800-693-4800. They're experts in handling cases before the U.S. Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims. Their number again, 1-800-693-4800.
And we're back on Veterans Radio, Bob Gould, right here on Talk WHAM 1600. I have with me author John C. McManus, author of September Hope, and Kevin Himmel, our General George Patton. He's also, Kevin has a number of books on Patton. But right now, September Hope. John, why did you write this book?
I wrote the book because I felt that Market Garden was very well known, especially the Bridge Too Far film and the great book by Cornelius Ryan. And there was a lot done on what happened to the British Airborne up in Arnhem, which, of course, is a tragedy. The unit gets annihilated, and the operation eventually fails. But I felt that what had been overlooked, relatively speaking, was the American side of the story, the two U.S. airborne divisions that were part of this ill-fated operation, and that there really had been no book that just focused primarily on that. We'd had some coverage of it in Band of Brothers, through the eyes of one unit. We'd had some coverage, of course, in A Bridge Too Far. but not really the comprehensiveness that I felt was appropriate. So I wrote September Hope with that notion in mind, and also taking a look at, you know, the larger consequences of the failure of this whole thing. And I also wanted to get a sense of the high command and why this decision is made and how the personalities eventually influence the experience for the soldiers on the ground. But my specialty and my approach tends to focus on the average soldier in the end.
Now, when you how long did you do the research to before you put this all together, September Hope?
I did the research for the better part of about two and a half years or so, and researched at multiple archives. The most useful ones, of course, the U.S. Army Military History Institute in Carlisle, Pennsylvania, which just has a rich treasure trove of soldier sources. The Cornelius Ryan Collection at Ohio U, which is really remarkable because Ryan, in the 60s, sent out questionnaires to hundreds, if not thousands, of veterans or participants in Market Garden, and not just the soldiers and not just the Allies, but some on the German side, a lot of the Dutch, particularly Dutch resistance, and civilians, and, of course, there were many American accounts, surveys, memoirs, diaries, letters, pictures, all this really neat stuff. And you combine that with some of the official sources and documents and the combat after-action interviews, you can really, in a way, bring the story life in a literary sense. That was very exciting to me.
So now, okay, we have this column. This column is now going to punch through the German lines. It's gonna have a breakout. And I'm not a commander, but I'm looking at single roads. One road. It wouldn't take much for this whole thing to become bogged down, to become stalled, and well, how did this all start, and when did the first stall take place, John?
The first stall takes place actually on the first day when the Germans are able to blow up a bridge at a place called Sun, which is just outside of Eindhoven, and it's about ten or a dozen miles behind the front lines, and it's where you were going to have the first link up with the U.S. paratroopers and the British tanks. And when the Germans are able to blow up that bridge, it forces the Allies to spend about 18 to 24 hours, their engineers, in rebuilding it and putting their own bridge in to make sure that it's heavy enough or suitable enough for vehicles. So, you know, really, in the end, I like to describe this as a zero-defect operation. It was only going to work if everything went right, and pretty quickly something goes wrong, which creates a delay, which gives the Germans more time, which allows them to counterattack and figure out what's going on. It allows them to besiege the British airborne up at Arnhem and also in a nearby suburb of that city called Osterbeck. And it also allows them to launch very, very strong, powerful counterattacks against the 82nd Airborne at Nijmegen and, of course, the 101st. And so the Allies end up in this running battle in which they're desperately trying to hold open this corridor and trying to get across the key bridges, all in enough time to save the British airborne at Arnhem and fulfill the larger purpose. Well, I would say within about 3 days or so, Market Garden has devolved into a veritable rescue operation for the British airborne up around Arnhem. So it's not going to yield you the kind of results you want.
Now, tell us about the airborne experience and some of the dramatic combat incidents, John.
Yeah, these guys in the airborne end up in some pretty intense close combat. The drops are largely successful. They take place in broad daylight, in good weather. September 17, 1944 is the date when the Market Garden was launched. It was a good weather day, although subsequent days did not have good weather, so that it meant that resupply was difficult. But in many instances, the paratroopers, as they move toward their objectives, sometimes little bridges over canals or portions of Nijmegen or Eindhoven or little towns or whatever, end up in these sharp, intimate firefights with small groups of Germans who are like hodgepodge units. They just happen to be there. You also have two understrength SS divisions, 9th and 10th SS Panzer, who end up in the mix as well. And so most of these paratroopers are going to remember just this kind of jarring experience of within a day to a day and a half that they are fighting for their lives often on the defensive as this thing unfolds, trying to hold on to what they have. And alongside that, it's almost kind of surreal, alongside that is the liberation experience with the Dutch, who are, of course, quite excited about this whole operation and have their own Dutch resistance who are part of it. And so the Americans absolutely love their interaction with the Dutch. It's something they never forget, and vice versa. But the tragedy of it all is that these very same folks whom you're liberating in their villages and suburbs and in the larger cities like Nijmegen, it all ends up as a battle zone, and their homes get destroyed, and people are displaced. And the Americans really have a sense of personally owning this battle in the sense of fighting for these folks. And there's a friendship that has never ceased to abate.
So did the Dutch underground resistance, did that rise up and give a hand?
Yeah, the Dutch underground and resistance was a big part of Market Garden from the beginning. You have, for instance, a very prominent Dutch liaison officer, Captain Arie Besterbercha, who was attached to the 82nd Airborne Division headquarters. He jumped in with the leadership group of the 82nd Airborne Division. He was from Nijmegen. He was a former speed skater, Olympic speed skater. He'd had really an interesting wartime experience before this, but he was to marshal all these competing Dutch resistance groups because there were political differences, and to try and point them in the same direction toward the Germans. And so you see that in the course of the operation, one of the great assets the Americans call upon is the Dutch fighters who are fighting alongside them, providing them with intelligence, lending them some fire support. And, you know, they didn't have the safety of a uniform in the sense of the laws of war being treated as a POW. If the Germans got them, they were probably going to execute them, and indeed that did happen. That's another situation in which the Americans developed a very deep respect for the Dutch. The Market Garden is of course, a deep disappointment in the end for the Dutch because it's a failure and it doesn't liberate their whole country.
Well, so now here's Eisenhower, and he's monitoring events as they're unfolding. And he's probably smoking now about four packs a day. And what's he thinking all this time?
Well, Eisenhower at this point, his headquarters has moved into the Paris area in Versailles. And, of course, he's managing the entire Western Front and hoping all along that this sort of gamble in Holland will pay off. He has a meeting within several days of Market Garden to kind of assess what's going on and to figure out what to do next. And the first reports are not very good, of course, but he's very disengaged from the battle in that sense of being miles away and in a communication gap. But one of the real downfalls of this whole thing and his relationship with Montgomery is that Montgomery did not attend that meeting. He preferred to stay at his headquarters in Belgium. And this was seen as a terrible insult by most of Eisenhower's staff and many of Montgomery's colleagues, including his own chief of staff. And, of course, it led to a further sense of disembodiment and disengagement from Eisenhower with this whole thing. And that's the curious thing about Market Garden. Those who conceived of it end up distancing themselves from it fairly quickly, not just Ike, but also Montgomery, who is strangely absent in a lot of the tactical decisions that have to be made. And so it falls to the commanders on the ground to try and patch something together out of this whole disaster.
Kevin, was the word getting out that things were not going well with Market Garden and that Patton found out about that? Was there any attempt to make a sort of a rescue mission by Patton the way he did over at Bastogne? Was there any talk of that?
No, not really, because there was an entire First Army under Courtney Hodges between Patton and Montgomery's army group. Patton was sort of disgusted with the whole idea, not just because he was losing supplies, but when he found out about the entire campaign, he said, you know, you can't run it up a single road. And it wasn't just a road, it was a raised road. So any attacking force is really going to be able to take aim at those columns of vehicles and tanks that are going to be above the line of sight. So Patton just thought it was a terrible idea in all directions. And it, just like John said, because it really had no alternative, that everything had to go perfectly for it to succeed. And it really left Patton just wringing his hands and shaking his head, thought it was just a bad idea from the beginning. He didn't see that it was going to have any success. And it just frustrated him to no end because he had been delivering the goods, so to speak, for the entire months of August. Why was he being deprived of this chance to continue what he was so successful at?
Now, John, what made it a bridge too far?
Well, that comes from something that General Browning, Boy Browning, who was the overall airborne commander, a British commander, who was nominally in charge of the three airborne divisions. It comes from something he purportedly said to Bernard Montgomery when Montgomery first briefed him on his idea, this plan. And Browning is said to have mentioned to him, well, you know, I guess it's a good plan, but we may be going a bridge too far, sir. And I've always been a little bit skeptical about that quote because no one else has really corroborated it besides Browning himself. And you would wonder to yourself, if Browning felt this way, then what was the point of the operation in the first place? And why not do something about it? But it's such a great image because it's so true that Arnhem was indeed a bridge too far as things played out, that the Allies were able to drive, a pocket leading from Eindhoven to Nijmegen and part of the way to Arnhem, but they weren't able to get all the way to Arnhem and really capture that bridge over the Rhine in the long run like they wanted to do. And, of course, it cost the better part of the British 1st Airborne Division in the offing. So, Cornelius Ryan seized on that quote, I think, just brilliantly in a way to capture the essence of the operation for all of us, even these many decades later.
You know, I'm going back to the movie, and at the very the British that were at Arnhem, is that correct? They were there, right?
That's correct.
And there was like a ceasefire, of which the wounded could get pulled out, and then the ceasefire ended because the Germans let the British take out their wounded, and then there was annihilation. Why didn't the British surrender?
Well, they eventually did surrender because they had really no other choice. But the British 1st Airborne Division was an excellent unit, with high morale, good training, excellent weapons, a superb light infantry formation that was determined to fight to the end. And they hoped, really to the end of the whole disaster, that perhaps other Allied troops might get to them and might rescue them. And indeed, you know, a couple of thousand of them did escape across the river. And there were also Poles who were in the perimeter, too, who suffered heavy casualties, a few of whom escaped. But in the end, they're not able to, the Allies are not able to really go in and rescue most of them. And that's the tragedy, this whole thing. The British see an entire airborne division decimated, and the Americans suffered heavily too, even though it wasn't quite that disastrous for them. But casualty rates within the first 9 days or so of these landings were about 50% in the U.S. airborne formations, and then the two U.S. airborne divisions were used as just static infantry to hold the line for much of the rest of the fall, and the casualty rates were between 30 and 50% from there on. So it was very, very costly.
Okay, we're coming up on our third and final break, and Derek, take it away.
Schoolcraft College is proud to have served the communities of Southeast Michigan for 5 decades, so it should come as no surprise that they're just as committed to serving those who have served our country. Schoolcraft College Veteran Services provides assistance to veterans using their educational benefits. They help with the VA benefits application process, provide academic advising, and plan programs of study according to VA guidelines. Classes are forming now in Livonia and Garden City. Visit schoolcraft.edu for more information.
And we're back on Veterans Radio. Now, the final segment, we want to thank all of our Veterans Radio supporters, American House, Legal Help for Veterans, Applebee's Restaurant, the Canton Community Foundation, Schoolcraft College, Lynn Pitlack, CPA, and Rally Point, the professional network for military folks. John, author, September Hope, why should folks buy your book?
It's a phenomenal book, the best you'll ever read.
I think it is. You know, I'd love to ask that question. I mean,
well, you know, if you've ever seen the movie A Bridge Too Far or read Ryan's amazing book, you may have felt that there was a little more to the story. And I think this is the rest of the story, particularly what it was like, you know, from the boots on the ground perspective of those paratroopers who went in there. And if you're ever interested in maybe getting a little more insight into Eisenhower's relationship with his commanders, and in command in combat, too. I really take a look at James Gavin, 82nd Airborne Division commander, in a great deal of depth. He left behind a tremendous trove of material, and he's a fascinating figure. He was 37 years old, and he's in command of a division. He breaks a couple of vertebrae in the landing, but doesn't know it until many years later. You know, he is sort of symbolic, I think, of a lot of these Americans who really fight their guts out in Holland in this really compelling human drama that ultimately, admittedly, is sad and tragic. But I think it's an important element of World War II that is a reason why the war ends the way it does.
Folks, it's a book is September Hope, The American Side of a Bridge Too Far. John C. McManus, whom has been a regular contributor on our program. And, John, I love catching your stuff on the Military History Channel, on the American Heroes Channel. And I bet they're really keeping you busy.
Most definitely. It's a lot of fun. Yeah, I appreciate you watching. And we've had a lot of good times with these documentaries.
Well, and this being 70 years after 1944, it is timely that we cover all of these major issues that were unfolding during 1944. We've only got a few minutes, John. What were the consequences of Market Garden's failure?
The consequence of Market Garden's failure is that the war is going to drag on through another terrible winter in 1944 and 45. Eventually, the Allies, in order to win this war, are going to have to go with a broad front attrition approach of just putting maximum pressure on the Germans and collapsing them. The other thing, too, is that Market Garden and its failure convinces Hitler that he can concoct one more massive offensive to try and influence the outcome of the war in the West. So really, Market Garden is the genesis of the Battle of the Bulge, an even bigger and worse battle that the Germans unleash in mid-December 1944, and is largely an American battle, and initially a disaster. So the consequences in the broader scope of World War II are rather dramatic because of the failure of Market Garden. From a Dutch perspective, it consigns the majority of Holland to a terrible winter of hunger and occupation, and it leads to this hope of liberation, which does not come into fruition until well into the spring of 1945. So it's not a happy ending to the story, but it does tell you a lot of why World War II turns out the way it does in Europe.
Well, I want to echo also, it is a phenomenal story. It's a phenomenal book, John C. McManus, September Hope. And we have Veterans Day coming up. So, folks, you want to go to the bookstore at veteransradio.net, www.veteransradio.net. Yep, and go in there and click on bookstore and find September Hope. Now's the time to order it. And also Christmas time. I know. I think you're rushing the season, man. Well, not really. It's now's the time to line all that up. And, boy, what better gift can you keep giving than to give your favorite veteran a book? Good. Kevin, back to you. All right, we've covered Market Garden, and we're going to leave the rest for the historians and also for those that buy the book. But somebody's got to cross the Rhine. It's going to be Montgomery or Patton. Who was the first?
It was good old George S. Patton.
Yes. Yes.
He got in one day before Montgomery. He snuck the 5th Infantry Division across the Rhine. I've interviewed some of the soldiers with the unit. They said as soon as they got to the river, normally they would get to the river, rest for a day, regroup. They said when they reached that river, there were boats waiting for them that night. And so Patton stole a march on Montgomery. He got a letter from the Secretary of War that said, we gave Montgomery airborne troops, equipment, even the Navy, and by God, George S. Patton has crossed the Rhine. So it was that was probably the last big hurrah for George S. Patton in World War II, was beating Montgomery across the Rhine.
Now, was that near the Ludendorff Bridge?
No, this is further south, a town called Worms, or Worms, and, the real plan was to have Montgomery cross first because he was going to be in an area of the German Ruhr, the industrial area of Germany, and if they could take out the Ruhr, that would take out the munitions center of Germany. Courtney Hodges' army cross first. They capture the Ludendorff Bridge in a very dramatic sweep with the 9th Armored Division rushing across, even though the Germans blew it, but they didn't have enough explosives to destroy the bridge. It raised up in the air and settled right back on its pilings. So that was the real first crossing of the Rhine. But the planned one was Montgomery from the get-go, but Patton still beat him, even though Eisenhower wasn't even looking that way for the big crossing of the Rhine.
But he did have he was aware that Montgomery did not cross, so this was his moment. Is that correct?
Oh, yeah. He called Bradley and said, hey, I'm across the Rhine. You know, don't say anything for the next 12 hours because I got to make sure I've built up my beachhead. But, man, when those 12 hours are over, you make an announcement so the world knows I beat Montgomery. He was acutely aware of that.
I can picture in my mind, there's Patton crossing on that, what would you call it, pontoon bridge.
Sure.
And
yep.
standing up in his Jeep and his beautiful, I mean, the man was impeccable. Wow, what an icon. And there he is standing up, and he's got his hands on the top of the windscreen, and he's going across. And it was now you can't quite get that descriptive, but something happened very quickly. Tell us, was that true?
I'll tell you the story real quick. There's actually two stories. One is he stops halfway across the bridge, gets out, number of soldiers around him snapping his photograph, even gives his camera to his aide. He drops his fly and relieves himself in the Rhine River, calling it the pause that refreshes. You know, there's a number of photographs of this. Once that's done, gets back in what was his command car, crosses to the other side, gets out and walks about 10 feet and falls down and picks up, stands up with two fistfuls of soil. And he says, hence William the Conqueror. And what he was referring to is when William the Conqueror went to England, he fell out of his boat on the English shore and came up with two fistfuls of sand and said, hence I have taken England with both hands. So here you have Patton with a sort of a vulgar act as he crosses the river, and then once he's across, you know, conjures up his own knowledge of military history and shares it with everyone around him. So I think that's a great dual image of Patton, the relieving himself in the river and, you know, making the historical quote in action once he's across.
I can see the average GI who I'm sure that went viral back then, the fact
viral,
of what he did in the middle of the river. And that was a boost, I would think, to.
Oh, yeah. Cheer went up. I think just about everyone. There's photographs of the Corps Commander Eddie doing the same. I spoke with Martin Blumenson, the Patton author who wrote the Patton papers. He was a soldier. He was an historian in Third Army. He said he did it too. So it caused a retroactive or a, a spark that went from soldier to soldier, and everyone started to mimic Patton's action as a salute.
Well, I'm sure that we can't revisionist history, you know, go back and say, but this was as big of an iconic moment as when the raising of the flag at Iwo Jima, you know, and well, Bob, that's not, you can't make that come. Yes, I can, because they wanted to, a lot of GIs want to stick it to Hitler, and they wanted to stick it to Goering, and they want to stick it to Goebbels, and they want to stick it to Himmler. And this was it. And I'm just so amazed that hasn't really had as much impact publicity wise. So I want to thank you, Kevin, very much for bringing all that wonderful. And will you please, because we have to cover Ardennes. This is going to be the 70th anniversary of Ardennes. Would both of you gentlemen come back in December so that we can talk about Alamo, the Battle of Ardennes?
I will come back if John comes back.
And John?
Sure, I'd be glad to. Yeah.
And in closing, we've got about what do we got, Derek? Minute and a half? No, we got 1 minute. We got 1 minute. Very quickly, John, wrap this thing up. Talk whatever you want to talk about. You've got about 50 seconds. Go ahead.
Well, you know, this week will be the 70-year anniversary of Market Garden. So just maybe sometime this week, take a pause and realize 70 years ago today, a lot of Allied soldiers were really fighting their hearts out to try and end the war early. And many of them were Americans. And I think it's a fascinating story.
Wow. I couldn't have said it any better. John and Kevin, thank you very much for being our guests. And next week, Jim Falzone's going to be here. That's right. Dale should be back, and Nina. This is Bob Gould, Veterans Radio on Talk 1600. You are dismissed.